From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Purple eyes in the canyon. Oh, hey there, Pally. Didn't see you there. I was just singing a song under this old devil moon, strumming my guitar. My name's Hunter Dino Deucing. And joining me now is a fella who's got a God Bless John Wayne bumper sticker on his automobile. Say hello, Mr. John Grace. How you doing?
Howdy, y'all.
And out in the outback of Australia, you don't find too many of those people out here in Presidio County, Texas. We've got Mr. Stuart Falk. Say hello, Stu.
Well, hello, Pilgrim. Let me just tell you, Angie Dickinson threw her tights at me, and instead of tossing them out of the window, I put them on later on when there was no one around, along with my blue dress.
Hey there, Pally. I think you're referring to unsubstantiated rumors about the Duke being a crossdresser. Those were spread by communists and liberals. I think you need to knock that off. You hear what I'm saying here, Pally?
Well, you know, I would, but there's those pictures.
I'll tell you, Dino here is going to knock back a few, and then I'm going to talk to my buddy Jerry, and we're going to come sell you straight like we did those ranches in Rio Bravo. You see what I'm saying?
Are you going to speak to your friend Jerry via a Ouija board?
Of course. Jerry is more powerful now than you ever imagined.
Yeah.
He's making Holocaust movies in the great beyond.
I did play with a Ouija board trying to contact Jerry Lewis with a glass, like me and my brother. And we managed to contact him, and he said, we said, Jerry, what's the one thing that you wish people would do when you're deaf? And he said, the message came back and it said, shut the fuck up about their clown movie.
Boy, hey, you stop talking about that fakakta clown movie, okay?
You know, that when he died, they actually like that's all he ever did, was make this clown movie that never released. You would think, God, that you didn't know he was the top comedy star for like a decade.
You had to go to France.
Boy, he's Rob Zombie pissed off and Jerry Lewis is dead now. Could have got the ultimate clown.
You had to go to France to get a proper obit on Jerry Lewis. You know what I'm saying?
God, it was ridiculous.
Because the obituaries here are just like, oh boy, that's just like hand rubbing. Now we get to see the day the clown cried and laugh at the worst Holocaust.
I know what fucking ghouls.
Yeah.
Have you even see Who's Minding the Store? The thing's great. What the fuck? I hate movie nerds. I hate
the studio. The studio is run by pimply-faced kids who've never seen Cinderfella or Who's Minding the Store.
Awful. Just fucking terrible. It's like, I hate movie nerds. I really do. I can't stand them. Movie writers, they're horrible. All of them.
Well, there was that, and there was also like, gee, you know, do you remember like that interview he did last year that was really awkward? Which was hilarious.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was just like, what? He was a totally conservative Republican. That's what they hated about him. They always hated him.
And, like, he was always... Jerry Lewis was very, like... I don't know. He was very politically incorrect and, like, didn't really care.
No.
Yeah, he said women weren't funny, you know.
Yeah.
He's right. For the most part.
Let's be honest. You're not supposed to say it now, which is the problem with the world today.
It's one of those things where... you know, I just remember, like, he would always do or say something, and people would get all pissed off about it, but, you know.
Oh, a friend of mine interviewed him, and he had her crying, apparently, within a few minutes. Like, he was vicious. But the thing is, I think he just didn't really like people in the business, and he didn't like reporters, and unless they were like Laura Ingraham's fill-in guy. You know, he gave him a nice interview.
But
Is it that Raymond Arroyo?
Yeah.
But, the movie we're talking about today stars one of Jerry's old comedy partners, Dean Martin, who's with John Wayne. And the movie is Rio Bravo, a classic Western directed by Howard Hawks, written by Jules Furthman and Lee Brackett. and starring Ricky Nelson, Angie Dickinson, my relative Ward Bond. Music by Dmitri Tiomkin. And Stuart.
Who did the music for The Thing from Another World?
Yeah, which was another Hawks production.
Yeah.
Yeah, that he did not direct or something. Yes.
Well, The Thing from Another World is like the classic movie version of Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Where people are like, was it directed by Toby Hooper or was it really directed by Steven Spielberg? Which, you know, people, it's generally accepted that Spielberg directed Poltergeist.
Yeah.
And I think he was like doing Toby Hooper a solid, you know.
All right.
And people say Thing from Another World, it says Christian Nyby's name on there, but it was, you know, they say it was Howard Hawks because it has his fingerprints all over it.
Mm. Yeah, I'm kind of like, where's the Blu-ray for The Thing from Another World?
Mm-hmm.
Still waiting. Yeah, I'm still waiting on it too.
I was wondering about
what
that.
In the fuck? It's one of my favorites.
I was thinking about that when I was watching Rio Bravo. I was sitting there going, wait a second. We've had like 5 Blu-ray releases of John Carpenter's The Thing. Where's my Blu-ray release of Thing from Another World? Shout Factory.
I think we've had 18. I've lost count.
I mean, no, seriously, dude. There have been so many. There's been like the studio one. You've got the Shout Factory one. You've got the Arrow Video one. You know, there's just
Endless. It's nonstop, and each one contradicts the last.
Where's my James Arness is a Vegetable Man movie, huh? Yes,
I want the one where you don't see the monster. It's so much better that way.
But Rio Bravo has a very interesting history because this movie was basically Howard Hawks and John Wayne. It was their way of kind of flipping the bird at another movie. It was them saying, hey, we don't like this movie where this guy's running around like a chicken with his head cut off begging for help and acting like a pansy. And we're going to make a movie about like a real man with a real moral center. And we're going to call it Rio Bravo. And the movie they were making fun of was what, John?
High Noon.
High Noon, this classic Western, considered a classic. It's a movie where a guy walks around a town and whines for 90 minutes.
Yeah. The strange thing is Gary Cooper was as much a conservative Republican as John Wayne.
Oh, yeah. Gary Cooper's a great actor. I'm not.
Yeah. That's the funny thing about it is, you know, libs will love High Noon so much, but Gary Cooper was big time conservative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, High Noon was this movie that it's a Western about a guy walking around going, why won't you help me?
Yeah.
I need help. Why won't you help me? What's the problem?
So it's like Jerry Lewis, directed by Frank Cash.
Hey, lady, why won't you help me? I need help from my Quaker wife.
I will say this. I watched High Noon when I was young, and I thought it was weird that he was asking for help. And then when I saw what his situation was, I was like, why didn't he just sit at the train station with a Winchester and pick him off as he got off the train?
I mean, it's like 3 dudes are coming to town to start some trouble, and
it's
this guy's
nothing.
Like, he's running around town freaking out, and everybody in the town's like, go away, dude. Like, chill.
Yeah, they're like, do your job. We pay you.
Like, you're the sheriff. They're like, you don't see cops coming up to my door going, excuse me, sir, but crime is really getting to be out of control. Well, I want to hand you this badge and a gun, and you are going to ride around with me.
No, I was going to say.
But, you know, High Noon was a movie about the Blacklist, right? I mean,
supposedly.
It was the Blacklist that doesn't exist, you know, that thing.
They all act like it's the worst thing that ever happened in America.
Like, what I love is, like, they're like, oh, the Blacklist. Oh, these writers couldn't work. There's this movie that's a total ripoff of High Noon that's better than High Noon called Terror in a Texas Town. It's written by Dalton Trumbo, and his name's not on it, but he was writing for it. He got work. And I got the
paid. He got paid.
And that movie's awesome, though, because Sterling Hayden, like, shows up to a gunfight with a whale harpoon.
Awesome. That sounds like Charles Bronson shit right there.
It's the only gunfight in a Western where the guy's like, no, I don't want a 6-shooter. I want a whale harpoon.
I have to watch this now. I think it's on my Amazon list.
Yeah. Arrow just put out. It's a pretty rad movie. I mean, it's just, but Sterling Hayden's like a Swedish immigrant. He's like, yeah.
Oh, God. I got to see.
Yeah.
Trumbo could write. I'm not dissing his talent.
Oh, no, he was a writer. Hell of a writer. He's a commie, but he was a hell of a writer.
A total commie chicken shit, but he was a great writer.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to be friends with him.
My favorite movies.
Yeah. But High Noon was like the... But speaking of the Blacklist, I was reading this book that... what's his name? He's this, you know, one of those hippie filmmakers from the 60s. I forget his name. It'll come to me. But he did this book... there's a book of his conversations with Orson Welles. He did that movie, A Safe Place.
It's not Bogdanovich?
No, it's not Bogdanovich. He's from that group of filmmakers. He did a movie with Welles called A Safe Place. That was part of the, you know, BBS produced it, which produced Bogdanovich's, Last Picture Show. It's gonna come to me like in the middle of the night. I'm gonna wake up and screaming this guy's name. But he did this thing where he recorded his lunches with Orson Welles, and there's a book out.
But those were long.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Dude, are you, I'm not. You're not kidding. Like the waiters come up, they're like, "Do you want your usual, Orson?
You know? Yeah. Do you want four plates or five today, Orson?"
Yeah, Elroy told me that when they found Orson Welles dead, the cops like would position him and make fun of him about how fat he was.
They should have stuck his fat body on a Nashua copier and taken some photocopies of it.
They may have. I'm sure the story is going to grow since I've been told the story.
The filmmaker I was thinking of is Henry Jaglom.
Oh, okay, okay. I would have never
guessed. Did a lot of artsy, fartsy stuff.
And other stuff nobody watches.
Yeah, like I saw A Safe Place and it was unwatchable. It was terrible. But anyway.
Praised by people who wonder why Kevin James movies do so well.
Yeah, exactly. No, seriously. It is exactly, you're on point there. It is.
A friend of mine pointed that out to me today. He was like, you know, all these critics will talk about all these supposedly artsy films, and then they're snobby about the fact that a Kevin James movie does so well. They don't even take any understanding.
Oh my gosh. By
the way, this friend's a liberal, though, but he did point out, he was like, you know, they don't even think to look from the working class point of view about why they find that stuff entertaining.
I would rather watch Here Comes the Boom 10 times in a row than watch A Safe Place again.
I like Here Comes the Boom.
Yeah, what about
Paul Blart?
I thought it was fun. I was like, why do people hate this guy so much? Oh, it's critics. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, anyway. Orson, they were talking about The Blacklist, and Orson Welles talked about The Blacklist like he was making a movie overseas, heard about it, and went, oh, okay. he acted like it. The way he talked about The Blacklist was as though it was a news item he heard.
Yeah.
That had his name mentioned in it. It was not something where he was like, oh my gosh, you know, it really made my life hard. He was just like, oh yeah, I heard I was blacklisted. And
he was already blacklisted by the studios because
he's a psycho. Yeah, he's a fat, crazy, you know.
He was like, working like in peplums and then spaghetti westerns with Thomas Milian and stuff. He was, you know, his career, he did David and Goliath in 1958 or 59, I think, the peplum that does the old Bible story, basically Italian peplum style,
right?
Dubbing and everything.
He was, you know, but anyway, like, so High Noon's a movie about the Blacklist, right?
Yeah.
And it's about like, oh, nobody will stand up to evil, which is like, the evil is like a young Lee Van Cleef before he was like Lee Van Cleef, he's like Lee Van Cleef and his pals come into town to like start a ruckus, you know, and... So Hawks and Wayne thought this movie was just crap and un-American. I think Wayne called it un-American. Like, they were like, why is this guy asking his Quaker wife for help?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
This is absurd. And so they wanted to make a film where you have a character who will not accept help from people who shouldn't be helping.
Yeah.
In fact, some characters who show up to help, they kind of make fun of them. it'll be who else is going to show up? The lady with the flower pot, you know?
Yeah, and I kind of wondered if some of those elements were lost on people who may have not seen High Noon or didn't know it was a reaction to High Noon.
Yeah, I don't think the movie like advertised itself as that. It was just sort of like, I think it was just Hawks going, well, here's my take.
Oh, it totally was. It was like, I just don't know if anybody actually picked up on that or if they were just confounded by those scenes or just thought they were quirky, funny stuff or whatever.
It's kind of hilarious. Like, you know, it's them holding up in a prison, and you know, it's a great. I mean, I think this movie. Rio Bravo, you know, being a reaction to High Noon, which is, you know, this overpraised Western, it's been much more influential on genre movies than High Noon.
Totally.
We can get to that in a little bit. But John and I have both seen Rio Bravo before. I think, you know, this was my second time seeing it. And, you know, it's definitely a movie that I like more and I feel compelled. I the second time watching it, I was like, oh, man, this movie's really great, you know. But Stu's never seen it.
No.
And I wanted to see what did you think of Rio Bravo? What were your first impressions, Stuart?
Well, remember we were going to do this episode about, I don't know, start of the year or something, earlier in the year?
Yeah.
I think it was before that. I think it was last year.
Oh, it could have been. Yeah, and
it's
got
a while.
Yeah, 15 minutes into it, and then my HD DVD of it died. Just froze up.
That's right. Oh, I forgot you were
watching. I wonder why that format failed.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Have you noticed Blu-rays? I've never, ever once bought a used Blu-ray and had a problem with it.
Neither have I.
I've yet to have an issue. I did have to clean a copy of Bram Stoker's Dracula that I found for like $2. And that's the only problem.
All the cleaning couldn't fix that shit.
Some to them, but it just seems like a more physically resilient format than DVD is.
It is.
DVD, you get the laser rot, and eventually they go bad, you know. And I've heard stories about, like, you know, pressings of Blu-rays being kind of rotten or whatever, but, you know, for the most part, like, I've bought used Blu-rays, and it's like, well, nope, you know, looks brand new.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are at stores where buying a used DVD is a coin toss, you know.
Right. Well, because you have people that buy them once and then decide they don't like the movie, but for some reason they feel like they have to experience the movie first through Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
You know, no, so I'm sure you got your Arrow shelf.
Oh, yeah. I got several Arrow movies used there at Movie Trading Company, you know, because people just check them out and sell them or rent them or I don't know.
Mm. Right, right.
Yeah.
I've never seen Blast Fighter.
So. Yeah. Anyway,
so got to watch it this time.
I scoured the stores, retail and secondhand for a high definition version of this. It has been released here on Blu-ray. I checked at about 2008, 2009. Gone. Can't find it anywhere. I didn't want to buy the DVD version of it because it doesn't have all the extras on it that the high-definition version does. So, anyway, I was catching up with my brother and Rob and another mate of ours Friday gone, and I thought, I'll send him a text and just see if he can find it in his house and drop it my way. So, I sent him a text. He sends me a text back later saying, hey, Stu, I've got it. I've got it! And that he'll bring it on Friday night. He gave me the movie, and I watched it today. Didn't realize it was as long as it was. I thought it was about maybe 100 minutes.
A long movie. For such a simple
it's too long.
Genre movie.
Yeah.
It is pretty long. I mean, it's over 2 hours. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You know, like, but yeah, so it is like a surprisingly long movie considering
always forget how long it is. Every couple of years I watch it, and I always forget it's actually like over 2 hours. Because I just never think it's being that long.
Yeah,
it's because it's so simple. I mean, it's not a complicated movie, but it does have a lot of like, I mean, like Quentin Tarantino's like a really big fan of this movie. And, you know, Tarantino loves like, you know, kind of long hangout dialogue scenes. And I think this movie's full of that, you know, and not in a bad
driven.
Way.
It's very
character driven. Like there's a lot of, you know, Wayne and Martin hanging out and, you know, talking at the jailhouse, you know, because a lot of the movie's them waiting around for like to get attacked, you know, and it's them like shooting the breeze. And, you know, a big part of the movie is Martin dealing with his withdrawal from alcoholism, you know, dude.
Yeah. And then John Wayne and Angie Dickinson constantly reciting the dialogue from To Have and Have Not. Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart spoke. It's the same goddamn dialogue. There was this great Howard Hawks documentary I watched where Angie Dickinson was like, she was so proud that she had done all those scenes in Rio Bravo, and like a week after she was finished filming, she was watching TV and she saw To Have and Have Not, and Lauren Bacall was there reciting all of her dialogue that she used.
But yeah, it is a this is kind of a hangout movie though. Like it's an action movie, but it has a lot of like these characters, you know, getting to know each other. And that's a big part of the charm of this movie, I think.
Yeah.
Is that the characters are so colorful and you enjoy spending time with, like, Stumpy.
Right. that's why it's rewatchable. That's actually completely if it was just action scenes like a Randolph Scott Western, you probably wouldn't think it's as immensely rewatchable as a lot of its fans do.
Mm-hmm. But so, Stuart, you said you felt it was pretty long, maybe too long. What are some other impressions you had?
Well, after I'd finished watching the movie, I just said to myself, I need to thank you guys for turning me on the Rio Bravo.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. I fucking hated it. It was terrible.
You know, John and I were like, I'll bet Stu hated this movie.
Yeah, I didn't like it at all.
Short attention span, Stu.
No, nothing to do with that. Nope. Nope. I honestly, I really think it comes down to cultural differences between you two and myself, where I cannot identify with Westerns at all.
Yeah, no.
I just don't think I like the Western genre.
Totally fair.
Yeah.
I don't
think I like the Western genre, save for a couple of things. And the things I do like are mere spoofs of them. The ones I do like, I was just going to say, are mere spoofs of them, which are Carry On Cowboy and Evil Roy Slade. I mean,
they're not even Westerns.
That's what I mean. But to me, they are. That's the thing I'm saying.
Yeah. Like Carry On Cowboy is a British Carry On film.
Oh, I know. Yeah. It's a British take on an American. Yeah. Totally. And Deadwood. I mean, I do like Deadwood, but that's more of a modern take on the Western. But there were a couple of things I did like in there, which I'll get to throughout the show. This is the first John Wayne film I ever saw as well, I must mention. I've never seen a John Wayne film.
Yeah, that's right. That was the whole reason we were going to do this movie, was you've never seen a John Wayne movie.
No. This is my first and my last. I'll never watch another John Wayne movie.
Oh, no, come on. Oh.
No, I really won't. I can't stand him.
Maybe. Okay, John, back me up.
Uh-huh.
Quiet Man. Maybe Stu could culturally, somehow, possibly, the Quiet Man. Maybe.
Does Stu hate the Irish?
Stuart, what are your feelings on the Irish?
Yeah, what do you think of the Irish?
Do you think?
Well, I had a run in with that Irish backpacker about 10 years ago, so I don't particularly like him.
Irish white or not? No, I'm kidding.
maybe like Brannigan, where Wayne is tearing up London as a Chicago cop.
Oh yeah,
Sir Richard Attenborough is the police chief, going, "We need to prove your methods." Huh? You know, and he's just bitching that he can't find a good hamburger.
I will watch a John Wayne film if John Wayne doesn't talk.
Okay, so probably have to look for the silence where he's a stuntman or something.
Next week on the Midnight Movie Cowboys, The Conqueror. No.
Oh, is that the one who plays Genghis Khan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did that. I covered that on the show that I'm not naming.
Yeah, we don't need to do The Conqueror. But the Quiet Man's this movie that takes place in Ireland that John Wayne did. That's kind of a classic. But
it's George Romero's favorite movie of all time.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. His favorite movie was The Quiet Man. He died listening to the score.
No kidding.
I'm not kidding. That's what was reported.
Listen to The Quiet Man become The Quiet Man. I guess it's.
But you know, oh my god. Okay, but. I don't want this to become a George Romero show.
Right.
Because, you know, I think we should do like a George Romero, like a lesser seen George Romero movie in the future.
In other words, we're going to do some boring artsy thing. Like there's
Martin. I was going to say There's Always Vanilla.
I hate Jack's Wife. I have never seen There's Always Vanilla. I don't want to see it. I don't care.
Oh, no. You want to see a lesser seen Romero film? Watch Bruiser.
Oh, yeah.
I hate Bruiser.
It was horrible. It was horrible.
Yeah, the Misfits at least got Romero to direct a music video for them.
Yeah. Yep. Oh my gosh, I forgot all about Bruiser. man.
So bad.
But John said something on Facebook that I thought was incredibly true. On Facebook.
Shitbook. All right, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the, you know, anyway, I'm not going to say what I want to say. Anyway, but John said that Romero was probably more influential to the indie movement than John Cassavetes, who's often cited as the father of the indie movement. You said it was really Romero. And I think that is 100% accurate.
No, I'll stand by that.
I was looking at my John Cassavetes box set, and I was like, literally none of these movies are movies I want to watch.
So why'd you buy it?
Nobody meant to see them. Nobody saw them. Just critics. Like,
these are movies that were watched by a very small contingent of California and New York intellectuals.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, John Cassavetes is a great actor, and, you know, I think he had some... Like, you know, Woman Under the Influence, I saw it, and I was like, okay, that's an interesting movie, but I never want to see it again.
Yeah.
Killing of a Chinese Bookie, I was like, okay, that's an interesting movie. Never, ever, ever want to watch it again.
Seen it once, Shadows, never again.
Shadows was a nightmare to sit through. It was so boring.
It's for the black turtleneck crowd. It's for the guys who
are... It really is. And I was like, this guy is not the father of indie cinema. This is a narrative that's been constructed by college professors.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, yes, Night of the Living Dead launched a million more indie film careers than... one John Cassavetes movie
completely
did.
Yeah. Totally, it was like he showed the way.
He did, like, you know, just look at pop culture now. I mean, zombie movies are like a dime a dozen. Like, anybody who wants to start making movies will just do a zombie movie. I mean, it's because of Night of the Living Dead, you know. And and even like the more artsy schmartsy indie movies we see today are more inspired by Martin than Shadows.
Yep.
You know.
Totally.
Like, there was a movie that came out recently. I forget what it was called, but it's like, it's one of those indie vampire movies. And you look at it, and it's like, this is Martin.
Yeah.
But, you know?
They're all indie vampire films are Martin. All of them.
Yeah, they are. Completely. All of them. All of them. Like, even like the artsy low-budget horror movie is inspired by Romero.
Yep.
The mass culture horror movie is inspired by Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, all that stuff. And then you have the very artsy, like, kind of esoteric genre movie, Martin.
Cronenberg's early movies are really just pretentious ripoffs of Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
they came from Within, or it's now called Shivers, Rabid, all of them. They're
and complete. another recently dead horror filmmaker. I mean, I think Toby Hooper is also very important to indie movies with Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah, that's probably the other significant. That's probably the most significant horror film in the last 40 years.
Yeah. No, but it's just I just when you said that on Facebook, I was like, that is a very keen insight.
Because people think since the 90s, they think indie films are a genre. They're not. Yeah. That Kevin Smith does not. It was not the only him and a future subject for a potentially horrible show. Ed Burns. They're not. They're not owners of indie show. You know, of indie cinema. They're just guys who made chatty celluloid sitcoms. They didn't make indie films as a genre. They just made stupid comedies that everybody thinks that defines the indie film.
They're feature length sitcoms.
But, yeah, that's all they are. They're like bad Fox pilots or something.
Anyway, but back to Rio Bravo. So John, I mean, not John, Stu, you said this is the last time you'll be seeing a John Wayne movie.
Yes.
I'm hoping you were joking.
I'm not. I'm really not.
So what did you, so you didn't find John Wayne appealing, and I'm going to say, I'm going to just ascribe the cultural thing to this, but what was it about the John Wayne that you did not like?
Connect. You can't act.
I hear that a lot, and I hear that from
he's a one note monotone. You know, people pick on Charles Bronson. At least Charles Bronson has some sort of range when it's required. John Wayne's just the same. It's just he's so American. And I'm not putting him down because of that. I'm just saying he's so ingrained in the American culture that for someone over here, I don't see the appeal of him.
I think it's very keen. I think it's very insightful that you note it's a cultural thing, because everybody I've ever known who says, I think John Wayne's a terrible actor, is not American. There's something about, and I'm not saying, like, you know, you're bad because you're not American or something. I'm just saying, like, I've just, that's a pattern I've noticed, that people who don't like John Wayne and say he can't act are usually, like, you know, Anglosphere Brits.
But then again, my best friend, who is obviously Australian, has every bloody John Wayne movie in existence he can get his hands on and loves him.
No, it's true. It's true. I mean, I'm not saying it's universal. I mean, I think there is something that – but I think there is a cultural thing there. Like, there is something that is about – I think there's something about John Wayne that is like this American ideal. Like, I was watching Rio Bravo with my girlfriend who'd never seen it, and she was, you know, kind of – she was going like, isn't it amazing how John, she was just talking about how sexy John Wayne is without trying,
Really?
Because he has a commanding presence. That's what it is. Cause he's tall.
I don't think so. Older.
She was actually Googling, the height of Dean Martin and John Wayne while she was watching it. Cause she was like, how tall are these people? Cause John Wayne looks like a Nephilim lumbering around like this movie. Like, he's so tall.
The whole thing was, I didn't buy the whole Angie Dickinson chasing after John Wayne. It's like, no way. After Dean Martin, I understand. After Ricky Nelson, yeah, I understand. But not after John Wayne. It's just like...
One thing about John Wayne in this movie is that this is not like a movie made in the 40s directed by John Ford. This is like kind of later period. It's 1959. Howard Hawks only made a few more movies after this.
Yeah.
Like, Wayne's a bit older in this movie.
Right. Well, Land of the Pharaohs had flopped, and Hawks went to Europe for a few years and took a break. And then he noticed that on TV, it was mostly Westerns. Most of the drama shows were Westerns. The cop series hadn't really come into form. And he noticed that people were watching these TV Westerns not because of the stories, but because of the characters. They're very character-driven shows. They're watching Bonanza because they like the Cartwright family, or Gunsmoke because they like Marshall Dillon and Chester Proudfoot, or they might think Paladin's a cool character on How Gun Will Travel. So he decided, well, I'm going to make a character-driven Western, and that's why it's this super long film, because he decided he was competing with television. Television was killing movies at the time, and so you'll notice this shot in VistaVision or whatever, 1:6:6, whatever the ratio is, and he made it like this, and he didn't like to shoot widescreen at all. And so he didn't, but he made it like this very long character-driven Western. He's like, well, they'll want to spend, you know, 2.5 hours with Dean Martin, Ricky Nelson, and John Wayne, and this new actress I discovered, Angie Dickinson, who'd only done TV at the time. And she, John Wayne was apparently pretty, you know, he was like not really sure about the whole romance thing with Angie Dickinson because he was so much older. He didn't know if audiences would buy it. He was bothered by it.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I do think, you know, he's bothered by it, and Stu was bothered by it. But I do think women find John Wayne at that age attractive.
I didn't find it far-fetched because...
my girlfriend was talking about how sexy John Wayne is in this movie. You know,
I have seen young women fall, very good-looking young women, like in their early 20s, fall for men, you know, in their late 40s just because they're the authority or the boss.
That's right. Yeah. That's my life.
Well, like, women, what women find attractive is not the same as what men find attractive. Men are more attracted to, like, you know, physical things. Women are more attracted to, you know, authority and...
a man who looks like he can take care of things.
Yeah, exactly. And John Wayne, if you look up a man who can take care of things, is, like, next to that in the dictionary. Like,
yeah, people don't realize it, but when the early Steven Seagal movies were out, I remember young women saying, that guy's sexy. And I didn't get it, being a young guy.
Not now.
It's like, yeah, but then a friend told me, he goes, no, women like a guy who looks like he can take care of things. And that's the whole thing. He's just tall, and he looks like he can take care of business.
He looks like he's going to protect you. I mean,
yeah,
you
know, he's like super protector. So it's
looks like he's going to protect you and put you in a fucking sex trafficking ring.
Yeah, well, nowadays, you know, this is the early Seagal before we just knew him as, oh, he's the guy married to Kelly LeBrock who worked as a bodyguard and taught Aikido in Japan. You know, it wasn't before all the crazy
I broke Sean Connery's hand.
Training him for Never Say Never Again.
One question I had about Rio Bravo was, John Wayne is known as the Duke, right?
Yeah, that's what
the name. Was Dean Martin's character of Dude like a comic piss take of it?
No, it wasn't.
No?
At the time. Okay. I actually wonder if Dean Martin's character, like, you know, dude is a common slang term you know, used by surfers and stuff. So I'm wondering, did that actually start with Dean Martin in this movie? Because this movie was super popular. I also know that Wayne says "That'll Be the Day" a few times, I think, in this film. And then Buddy Holly had seen it, and that's when he wrote that famous song.
Wasn't Buddy Holly dead by then?
Yeah. No, Buddy Holly was, I think, it was either Rio Bravo or it might have been one of his other 50s westerns, but I think it was Rio Bravo. I just remember that weird factoid, but when I was watching it this time, I forgot to listen to see if he
Buddy
said
Holly
it.
Died in 59.
Yeah.
So,
well, That'll Be the Day may have been, you know, music business went fast then, so I don't
know. This movie came out after he died, like a month later.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely... Put too much on the Duke, man. He's not...
It was either Red River or The Searchers, but it was one.
Red River is another great Howard Hawks. And speaking of, you know, John Wayne is known for his collaborations with Howard Hawks, but he's more known for his collaborations with John Ford. And, you know, I really love the John Wayne, John Ford movie, but they are totally different than the movies Wayne made with Hawks. And John, you've told me a few times that you prefer the Hawks movies to the Ford movies with Wayne. And I was wondering, I wanted you to elaborate on it. I think I know what the reason is. I'm going to guess that it has something to do with the sort of high-mindedness of the Ford movies.
Yeah, but I just Googled. I'm using Google for the last time because it keeps selling my info to Facebook, I think. But That'll Be the Day was actually in The Searchers. That's actually where Buddy Holly got the line from. He kept saying it in The Searchers. That was like his line.
Which is one of the John Ford movies.
Yeah, one of the Ford movies. So then Buddy Holly was inspired to do the song That'll
Be the Day. Which, by the way, Stuart, I know you said you don't want to see another one, but The Searchers is a John Wayne movie. You should totally.
I actually have it, but I didn't buy it because it came as part of a 3-pack on the Blu-ray with The Wild Bunch. That's why I bought that.
I will say that is a Western that you should definitely watch. I mean, it's one of my.
No,
you may or may not like it, but you should.
You actually may not like it, but I would say you should watch it.
That's a mandatory film. That's like,
it really is. I think it's considered one of the great classics, and I love it. But, you know, I think you should definitely watch it.
Yeah, I think my issues with the John Ford films, the high-mindedness annoys me. It's a little pretentious. And also, he has a tendency to go from, like, a tragic scene to, like, stupid Irish comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a very negative. Like, there was comedy in The Searchers that I felt, last time I watched it, and this is, like, 15 years ago, I felt like it was inappropriate considering the seriousness of the previous scene. And I also don't find it funny, so it's just like...
When he shoots the eyes out of a corpse, he goes...
Yeah, it's just, hey, you know, there's just...
You know what the Indians say? You can't walk in the land of the spirit world. And that bald guy who's in every John Ford movie is like, no, don't get...
Yeah, it's bizarre. And I remember for a long time when I was watching a lot of John Ford movies to try to familiarize myself with the history of Western film, because I was really getting into that, I preferred his team-ups with Henry Fonda. I thought Henry Fonda was a better lead in the Ford movies than John Wayne. And my favorite was Drums Across... Drums Across the Mohican? Is that what it is? Or something? It's like Drums Across the River. Across the River.
Across the River, okay.
Yeah, I love that film. I saw it when I was a little kid at on a TV in Reno, Nevada when we took a vacation there and kind of remembered it. And when I saw it again, I just loved it.
How the fuck do you remember recently, all the places and dates and times of shows and movies you watch?
Just if you're on the road a lot, like for vacations, you just kind of remember weird stuff like that.
You know what? I will say that's true. If I'm on a vacation, I will remember the time and place I watched a movie way more than if I saw something at home.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's just something I remember.
I watched Meek's Cutoff. Which was not a movie it was just kind of okay. I thought it was an interesting concept, but I really remembered it because I watched it when I was on vacation. You know, like The Founder, the Michael Keaton movie about Ray Kroc. I watched that when I was on vacation, and I have much more vivid memories of it, and it's because I was watching it in a different place. So you associate that movie with a very specific place that you have only been to once.
Yeah. You know?
And I think that's why.
A bit like when me and Rob took a holiday to Queensland and we watched that Paul Hogan movie Flipper. Oh, God. fucking terrible.
But I like a John Wayne movie I saw recently that I thought was very good, but it was very high minded. Was Fort Apache with Henry Fonda.
I like it, but I totally agree.
But it is a very like, oh, we're going to make this big statement about history, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think like as far as John Ford movies goes, Stagecoach is a very straightforward movie, like Rio Bravo.
That's good movie.
Sort of a. Oh yeah, I love Stagecoach.
Does he talk in it?
Criterion, I think.
Yeah, Criterion released it. It's a. It's the movie that made John Wayne a movie star.
Does he talk in it?
Yeah, he does.
Oh shit, Dan, obviously.
But but you know, when
I'm going to see how much I can bash the Duke before you two crack and stop hurling me insults.
we're just leathering up our skin. But
let me say this. I will say this. I think I may have gone in watching this movie with the wrong attitude because all I heard was Assault on Precinct 13 was a direct remake of Rio Bravo.
Which
is not true.
It's true in a very broad sense.
Okay.
Like, the broadest sense possible, but as far as the movies go, like, I see more influence on Tarantino than I do on John Carpenter, but John Carpenter's on the commentary track for this movie.
No, he loves the film, and in fact, he edited Assault on Precinct 13, and I think he used...
John T. Chance.
Yeah, he used the name of John Wayne.
Yes. I forgot about that. That's good.
So I was looking for the beats, the same beats of Assault on Precinct 13 for Rio Bravo, and while they're talking and talking and talking, I'm like, oh, fuck, this is just going on and on.
The very first time I saw this movie, I had the exact same expectation. And
right.
I kind of went, okay, the second time, I this is like really my third time seeing it. But the first time I saw it was kind of an abortion because I was expecting a John Carpenter movie and I didn't get that.
Yeah.
And so when I finally did see it, I was expecting, you know, just whatever the movie ended up being. And I went, okay, I can see the influence on Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, but it's very broad. It is a skeleton concept. And I think this is a good time to segue into the third part of the discussion I wanted to have, which was Rio Bravo's influence on other movies, because this movie has been remade a number of times, twice by Hawks and Wayne themselves. But
really?
The Carpenter influence, though, is I think John and I were talking about you know, preferring Hawks to Ford. And like, to me, John Ford is like the American Kurosawa in a way, like when it comes to the Western, like, you know, he kind of wrote the book on a lot of it, but Ford's movies were like very much about the West and about, you know, these big themes and concepts. Whereas Hawks, I remember William Friedkin was dating Howard Hawks' daughter, Kitty.
Yeah.
And
Made Boys in the Band.
Yeah, he just made Boys in the Band. And Hawks saw it and kind of went, why are you making these like this like artsy gay stuff? You know, and I don't mean gay like in a disparaging way. I mean, that's a movie about gays. And he said –
and Friedkin said, if you think this is artsy, you wait till I make Cruising.
He said, if you think I'm in good with the gays now
– you ain't seen nothing yet.
Kid, nobody goes to a movie to hear about people and their problems.
Yeah, he said – he goes, I made movies about genre. He goes, yeah. I made movies like Westerns and noir, and he goes, and people really liked those. And Friedkin said he took that to heart and made The French Connection and The Exorcist.
Yeah, because he actually told him, he said, you know, this bullet is out. That's a good chase picture. Why don't you make a better one?
Yeah, yeah. Like, Howard Hawks.
The French Connection.
To me, like, a lot of these directors like John Carpenter and Friedkin and people like that are children of Howard Hawks. Yeah. Because Howard Hawks made a Western. He didn't have any high-minded stuff behind it. Howard Hawks was just like, I want to make an entertaining movie. And the same with his noir pictures, the same with his screwball comedies like His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. You know, Hawks was a genre master. Like, he was one of these guys who just plug into sci-fi. He could plug into Westerns, comedy, whatever. He could just do it.
Did he make His Girl Friday? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did.
It's a good movie. I really enjoyed that one. I saw it on TV years ago.
Blondes, which I love.
Oh, yeah, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, yeah.
And I don't like Marilyn Monroe movies, and I loved it. Because it's really Jane Russell is the Hoxian woman in the film, not Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, that's
true.
Who
couldn't play that type of role anyway, but Jane Russell is great in it. And he did To Have and Have Not. You know, he did, to me, he did a lot of the better Bogart movies. He produced one that I really like a lot. It's one where he teams up with like Jackie Gleason and a bunch of other comedians of the day to fight Nazis in New York. It's, you know, he was just, I think Carpenter had pointed out, he said that Ford to him was an immigrant director. He had an immigrant's view of America. And he said Hawks was very much an American director.
That's a very good way of putting it. You know, to me, Carpenter is kind of the, and he's kind of the old style liberal filmmaker.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like he's not a social justice warrior filmmaker, like this new kind of communist, this new sort of like Antifa world order. It's very much like an old, like left type thing.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you could see that because Ford definitely has this sort of Irish immigrant view of America. Yeah, I think that's very accurate.
Well, no, Carpenter's like a classic liberal. It's more individualistic, doesn't like authority.
He's more of a libertarian, really.
Yeah, like, he does. He won't admit it, but, you know.
Like, I see a lot of people, I see a lot of dumb people, frankly, taking Carpenter's They Live and applying it to Alex Jones. Like, Alex Jones is representative of the global world order.
Yeah, you know? I think he's basically the underground.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, Alex Jones is not, you know, but I see people applying, like, the They Live stuff to that, and I'm like, no, dude. Like,
it's really the dark web is the underground. I mean, it's like, and that's a very libertarian element.
Yes, right now.
Yes. That's where people are buying drugs, they're buying anything they want, it's just the dark web.
Yeah, the dark web's kind of, you know, become a thing in the news.
I think Carpenter's problem is he thought he was a good screenwriter, and he's not. He's great when he's working, like, you know, Burt Lancaster's kid wrote The Thing. It's like, that's why it's so good, because Carpenter didn't write it.
Yeah, Carpenter has some issues as a screenwriter. He has some writing partners that are good.
I think Deborah Hill balanced him out better.
Oh, right? Yeah. Deborah Hill was fantastic, yeah.
You know, and it's just like, I think he needs a co-screenwriter.
Nick Castle, I think, had some good sensibility.
Nick Castle, I think, worked on Escape from New York and probably made it funny. You know, brought the humor to it that he needed. Because he wrote it as a Clint Eastwood or a Charles Bronson movie. Like I said, he was totally plagiarizing The Enforcer, which I realized when we did that show. You know, because he's always wanted to do a Dirty Harry film, but, you know.
But Assault on Precinct 13 is the one that is constantly held up as a remake of Rio Bravo.
Yeah,
but
it's not.
It is a remake in so much as it is an attack on a prison.
But it does have those long dialogue scenes.
It does.
In fact, I have shown it to people. They did not like it because of the dialogue. Like, they didn't get into, and I showed it to women, they did not like the lengthy back and forth because that's considered an outdated form of, you know, these long dialogue scenes. But this is before Tarantino made the big comeback of the super long-ass dialogue scenes.
Right. I think people expect the big siege and the big, they see Assault on Precinct 13, they hear about Rio Bravo, and they expect that sort of big action bonanza. And there's plenty of action in this movie, but it's more of a dialogue-driven film. But another movie that I think is a total, like, kind of comedic take on this is Blazing Saddles.
Yeah,
completely. You know, like the Dean Martin character is definitely the Gene Wilder character, the gunman who succumbed to alcoholism. You know, Cleavon Little is the sheriff who's made an enemy of everybody in the town, except instead of because he's taken a guy prisoner, it's because he's black.
By the way, Blazing Saddles couldn't be made today. Let's repeat the often repeated point.
Oh, yeah.
Since Mel Brooks said it. He has said it could not be made today.
Yeah, no, you couldn't make it today.
Couldn't make Rio Bravo today. You can't make a character-driven film.
No.
No, you couldn't make a movie about a groveling Mexican.
They have to be fighting for citizenship in 1880. You know.
Have to be a member of La Raza or something.
They'd have to have a child with a Ducker t-shirt on.
Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you, the most recent remake was the Schwarzenegger film, The Last Stand, directed by the Korean guy. Yeah,
Kim Ji Woon.
That was totally Rio Bravo. The whole plot was Rio Bravo.
You're right. It is. but the two people who remade Rio Bravo were Wayne and Hawks. Eldorado and Rio Lobo are both remakes of Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
Well, they sound like the name of ZZ Top albums.
But, have you seen both of those movies, John?
Yes. And Eldorado is, that's actually a big fan favorite because I think AMC runs it all the time. But they censor James Caan's ethnic humor scene where he impersonates a Chinese guy. And the last one, what was it, Rio Lobo or whatever? Mm-hmm. That I saw a few times on video. I've never been as impressed with it, but I keep waiting for a good-looking video print to be released. And the funny thing about that film is Sherry Lansing, future wife of William Friedkin and also president of Paramount Pictures, plays a Mexican seductress of sorts in the movie.
Yeah, looks great. That was Hawks' last picture, was Rio Lobo. And Lee Brackett wrote both of those movies, too.
Yep, he would get her to do rewrites on anything, and eventually she made her living basically writing scripts for him.
And she with Eldorado, she kind of protested. She was like, aren't we just kind of doing Rio Bravo again? And he was like, that's fine.
Before that, she had a career like writing science, like Edgar Rice Burroughs style science fiction, which she actually wrote very well.
She worked on Star Wars too.
Yeah, because Lucas was a big admirer of the Eric John Stark story she wrote for the pulp mags, where he was a warrior of Mars, just like John Carter, except she wrote it with a more gritty, kind of like a Western in outer space that I think always appealed to a lot of fans back then.
Yeah, she worked on Empire.
Yeah, she wrote the first Empire script, which was a bit different from what Lawrence Kasdan reshaped it into.
And became immortalized as a sheriff in John Carpenter's Halloween.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Brackett.
Yeah, Lee Brackett,
She's a very good writer. I actually recommend reading her science fiction. I don't read a lot of science fiction. I do read Lee Brackett's stuff when I get the time.
Well, she did El Dorado, Rio Lobo. She also did The Long Goodbye with Robert.
Yeah, Altman. I think it's a good screenplay, and I like her work on The Big Sleep. That she rewrote William Faulkner's script, if you can imagine that.
She also did Hatari, another Wayne Hawks.
Hatari, I don't like much. That's doesn't work.
I've never found appealing, but
It's a boring film. It's just not that good. By the 60s, he was bloated. Like, Hawks just couldn't really direct lean stuff at all.
Well,
there's a James Caan race car driving movie that's just, you only watch it because it's so bad. It's like.
So I know this producer named Mike Ryan. I worked on a few of his movies. And his wife was one of the producers on The Sopranos. And he said he would go to the rap parties every year when The Sopranos would wrap up a season. And he said Peter Bogdanovich was there.
Oh, God.
Every time. And he said that every year he and Bogdanovich would argue about the late period, like, Hawks and Minnelli movies. And he would be like, dude, Hawks' later movies aren't very good. Like, you need to... He goes, because he comes from a time when... Howard Hawks is later like everything by these directors was shat on, and so he feels the need to defend every stitch of film that they shot, and the latest stuff is just terrible, but he can't admit it. And so he said that he and Bogdanovich would get into these arguments over like the later Hawks and Minnelli movies, saying that he would be like, these movies are no good. And he said that Bogdanovich would get all, pissed off and yell at him. And he said that at the end of the party, they would leave. And then he said the next year at the next rap party, Bogdanovich would walk up to him and pick up right where they left off.
I mean, El Dorado's really good. I totally recommend
it. Today, because I watched Rio Bravo and I was compelled by it, I went to the store and I bought Rio Lobo and El Dorado, and I started watching Rio Lobo. And I thought, I was like, okay, John Wayne's pretty old. The production. It's 1970. You know, the production values are...
He had one lung.
Spotty at best. And I was kind of watching it going, okay, like, this isn't as high quality as what I just watched, but I was enjoying it.
Yeah.
I did think it was enjoyable overall. So far, I haven't finished it yet.
It's carried more by John Wayne and the cast than Hawks is directing, because I think you'll notice it's very visually lackluster. And yeah, he wasn't, like, a greatly visual director, but you can't argue that his 40s and 50s. And
well, Wayne looks old and tired in it. Like, yeah, he doesn't...
He had one lung. He had, like, an iron lung.
Yeah, was that in this movie or Big Jake, or what was the...
It was, I think, all movies past, like, 68. I forget exactly when he had the surgery.
This was 1970.
He was still a top movie star in America. All of his movies would make money. Like, they would still be big hits.
It just goes to show, you know, the Duke is a draw.
Yeah, well, it was him and Paul Newman and Clint Eastwood. And then later on, it was Burt Reynolds.
That mustache is hard to argue. Well, Stuart, do you have any more thoughts on Rio Bravo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say I went about an hour or so before I realized that Angie Dickinson was in the film. I didn't know.
Yeah, she didn't look anything like she looks like.
No.
Very. When I was a kid and I saw this for the first time, I didn't realize it was Angie Dickinson until I read in, like, Wonder Malton's TV movies or whatever. Oh, and I was like, oh, that's Angie Dickinson. Yeah. I had no idea.
Looked great, though.
Yeah, she did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, she did.
I did like Dean Martin. Even though I felt his performance or his character was like one giant PSA for, you know, like an anti-alcohol PSA. You know, like, I'm trying to kick the booze. I'm sober. And it's like, okay, we get
it. I need to drink beer.
It's probably a necessary thing back then. That wasn't very much an acknowledged problem in society.
Well, because, like, DTs could kill you, you know.
Didn't particularly care for that stumpy guy. I felt like taking his other fucking leg off of
Walter
him.
Walter Brennan?
What are you talking about? What are you talking about there? Oh, blew your head up. By the way, I thought that scene was hilarious where Dino's got new clothes. He's taking a shower and Stumpy tries to kill him because he doesn't recognize him. And he's like, how was I supposed to know you were going to take a bath and that you were going to look normal and that you were going to look presentable?
I actually have Walter Brennan's record albums on CD.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. It's the old actor who played Stumpy. He's actually a legend in American film. And
really?
Television. Yeah, he starred in The Real McCoys, which was the first of the hillbilly comedies before the Beverly Hillbillies in Petticoat Junction. There was The Real McCoys.
You didn't know him. I wasn't a legend? You didn't know?
Richard Crenna. And it's funny, in the 1930s, he was actually a young man, and he was playing old men roles because he was in World War I, and mustard gas, you know, dropped by the Krauts basically strangled his vocal cords. And so he sounded like an old man when he came back from the war, so he played old man roles in the 30s films.
I guess that's what happened to Al Pacino in the late 80s.
Yeah, I would guess.
Yeah. So something happened.
In the trenches! So, yeah. Because the Pacino of the 70s is very much a high-pitched man.
Yeah. I did think that Rio Bravo looked magnificent the way it was shot. You can't fault that. But, yeah, I was overall bored. Just talk and talk and talk. And but there's barely any action at all. So, I was... heavily disappointed by it.
Well, I think it would be interesting to revisit the John Wayne factor with you in the future with something like The Searchers or...
Brannigan.
Yeah, but, Brannigan. Well,
what about
Brannigan
McHugh? I've heard that one's a good one.
Nobody talks about that movie.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. David Warner is the bad guy. It's just like, it's exactly what you expect if John Wayne is a cop, an American cop let loose in London. It is exactly the movie you expect. Expect it to be.
But see, by you saying that you think you'd like to revisit John Wayne in the future by doing The Searchers, you're trying to make me watch another John Wayne film, which I don't want to do.
I don't think the issue is actually John Wayne. You could try. It's like Western. I think it's a 1950s Western.
I think John bringing up Brannigan's actually a better idea. You know? Because For and as far as like I'm talking about, like, I think the Searchers would be enriching for used to, even if you don't like it. But Brannigan is enriching for the show, yeah. Which is more self-serving for me. So,
well, another thing is, like Stu mentions, the lack of action in Rio Bravo. But the fact is, there was really no such thing as an action movie in the '50s.
Well, and like I thought the action was a lot of like fun when they're like hurling dynamite.
Yeah, well, what I like is they're basically outwitting their opponents. They're not supermen with guns like a Clint Eastwood spaghetti western. No. They're walking down the street and nobody can hit them, and they're just killing everybody and stuff. And, they're actually believable shootouts.
And something, a tentacle of this movie too, you were talking about Clint Eastwood, that when Sergio Leone was making Fistful of Dollars, he told Ennio Morricone he wanted the score to sound like the El Degüello.
Yeah,
song, the slit throat song that they play, which was what the Mexicans supposedly played to the people at the Alamo, the slit throat song. But it kind of gives the movie that feel. But you know, when you hear that those horns off in the distance, but you kind of look at that and you go, oh yeah, that's the spaghetti western score that everybody would know, that Morricone sort of made iconic. Leone recognized the power of that as like a soundtrack, you know.
Yeah, Leone stole from Rio Bravo and Robert Aldrich's Veracruz with Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster as much as he stole from Kurosawa.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, like, so I think the influence of Rio Bravo on the spaghetti western also is a thing that needs to be noted. It's just, this is a movie that I think really is sort of a just important for its influence on cinema. Like, even if you don't like it, like if you watch it like Stuart and you sort of find it boring and dated, you have to at least appreciate the effect it had on movies and the way.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's obvious it's got a very big influence on films and its future generations, but it just
it just didn't do anything for you.
Nah, like I said, I just don't think the Western genre does it for me at all. One question I've got. As much like as I like Ricky Nelson, what was the point of him in this film?
They offered it to Elvis.
Yeah,
Elvis couldn't do it.
I was actually
it.
Thinking that.
Yeah, Elvis didn't do it because the colonel wanted too much money, and then Elvis was drafted in the army 2 months before they started filming. So they wanted like a young actor to bring in, probably to bring in teenage girl audience.
Yeah, I said the whole character of Colorado. I'm sorry, your hometown, John Colorado.
Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing. James Caan plays the same character in El Dorado, but his name is Mississippi.
that was a joke.
So I do have a connection with these movies that's strangely cosmic. But, you know, back then, you also have to understand that movies were kind of, they were populist entertainment. They were made for everybody. You had to have something for the kids. You had to have something for the wives. You had to have something for the husbands. They had to be like, that's why they were kind of, and Howard Hawks made those, he specialized in that type of movie. That's why all of his genre films, doesn't matter what he's making, it's got kind of the same appeal. It had to be entertaining for everybody. So if you put Ricky Nelson in there and you have a couple of songs from him and you have him singing it with Dino, you know, you've got music sales on the radio that can help promote the film.
Yeah, like, you know, Hawks put they were like, we've got a crooner in the movie, we need a song. So they did the My Rifle, My Horse and Me, or whatever, my Rifle, My Pony and Me, or I forget the name of it, but it was something like that.
It's different from today, where now all movies are basically made for 12-year-olds, and boys or girls, that's all it's made for. It's nothing made for adults.
They wanted to, yeah, you know, you've got the John Wayne appeals to a certain audience, Dino appeals to a certain audience, Ricky Nelson.
There was smart marketing involved there, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a huge hit. I mean, it was a monster hit. It was basically John Wayne's comeback western, because he'd had some flops doing some non-westerns for Universal, where he'd play like jet pilots and stuff. He's really miscast, I think, in those films. I don't care much for him.
What's the better film, Rio Bravo or The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance?
Rio Bravo.
I'll tell you Rio Bravo, because I just...
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, I think, is a good movie. But I think if you were to say which one I'd rather watch, I'd say Rio Bravo.
Okay. Yeah. Because the Gene Pitney song is awesome. That's all. Sorry.
So let's close it out. Stu, what would you give Rio Bravo out of 10?
This will probably be my last episode, because I'll be booted off after I say it's probably about 3.5.
Oof. Well, I'm going to...
And that's because only... I was going to give it a 3, but I thought, no, then it's going to be on par with Red Dragon, and it was a bit better than Red Dragon.
Well, yeah. I mean, dude, don't. You can't do that.
Yeah, so 3.5.
3.5. 3.5, all right. I give it a 10 out of 10. I imagine John gives it a 10, too.
I give it a 10. I watch it every couple of years, or every 3 or 4 years.
Thanks.
I like it more every time I watch it.
It's one of those movies, if you had asked me before this last viewing, I would have said 8. This time I say a 10.
And I will say this. I did not grow up a John Wayne fan. I didn't like him when I was a kid. I'd rather watch Spaghetti Westerns. But I feel like I kind of outgrew Spaghetti Westerns because now that I've lived in the West, I live in Colorado where a lot of these films are set, and I've been to New Mexico and Wyoming frequently. I can't see Almeria, Spain as America.
Well, here's my thing. I agree with that statement 100%. Because I grew up loving spaghetti westerns and not watching John Wayne movies.
Yeah.
Because, I often say Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the movie that made me see movies as something bigger than just something to occupy my eyeballs for an hour and a half.
And it had that effect on me, too, even watching it chopped and pan and scan on TV.
But, I made my girlfriend watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and I was kind of thinking when I was watching it, this is kind of a comic book movie for me. The Clint Eastwood and all that, it's very, this is a very, stylized reality. And I was thinking, I really do love there's a certain moral center that John Wayne has in his movies. And, the spaghetti westerns are very cynical. They're very, the heroes are very, dark. They're very brooding. Sometimes they're very immoral, and I think one thing I've grown to appreciate about John Wayne and his films is that John Wayne's movies, he is always a moral center. I heard an anecdote, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that during his last movie, The Shootist, which is kind of his swan song, there was a final shootout where he shoots a guy in the back or something, and in the script, and he said, I'm not going to shoot a guy in the back. That's, below me or something. He's like, that's just, ridiculous. I'm not going to do that. And,
Kill a bunch of Indians, but I'm not going to shoot him in the back.
Except, never mind. I'm not going to make the joke I was going to make. But I'm going to say that, John Wayne.
Did it involve somebody that we all know or did know?
Well played. No, but you took it to another level. But I think that John Wayne always had a moral center to his performances. Would you say that's accurate, John?
Yeah, even in Red River.
Maybe the Searchers. Even the Searchers does, to be honest.
Red River, he plays a villain. He's the villain of Red River. That's what.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are.
He's actually a villain. And one problem I had with Red River, I know everybody loves it, but in the end, he was obviously supposed to get killed. And the studio wouldn't have John Wayne die in a movie. And so they have this stupid ending where they yuck it up, even though his character's been an asshole for 90 minutes.
I remember watching Red River and posting something about how I enjoyed it, and you go, yes, but the John Wayne character deserved death.
He did.
He did.
When you watch it,
you're right. I mean, he's a horrible character.
Then
at the end of the movie, they're like, well, that was crazy.
Yeah, it was studio ending. There you go. Completely took the end. That's what happened. He was supposed to die at the end in the studio.
But when I talk about the moral center, though, I think I'm just talking about the John Wayne archetype in general.
Yeah, there's a gravitas to his movies that you don't find in a lot of other Western leads at the time.
And you'll find it in movies today where characters have this sort of, this sort of Anglo-American moral center that's, it's very absent from the kind of smarmy.
It's gone. It's you don't have normal American lead characters anymore.
Yeah, that's what's appealing about John Wayne, more so than the spaghetti western character, which is sort of always, he's just out for himself. The spaghetti western character, like the Clint Eastwood man without a name, right. Is just out to benefit himself. He's out to, you know, just whatever he can get for himself. And he's gonna screw over Eli Wallach, you know.
Right, and it's a testament to Wayne's acting, because everybody thinks he's playing himself. Truth is, he was Marion Morrison from Iowa. He wasn't from Texas. He didn't even like horses. And he did not grow up on a ranch. He was a valedictorian in his high school. And this is back when high schools would be on the level of your fifth year working towards a master's degree. And it's just like he was a really smart guy. He went out to Hollywood and found work in the Westerns and based all of his moves and looks on Yakima Kanut, the famous stuntman, who, you know, could just do any type of horse stunt, basically invented stunt work in Hollywood. And, you know, he basically, Marion Morrison became John Wayne. It was just, that was
yep.
the persona he became. That's not necessarily who he was.
No, it's true. He was sort of, it's funny. I tell people, if you watch The Big Trail, the Ra Walsh film with a very young John Wayne starring in, he is not John Wayne yet.
No, he looks like he could be Doc Savage.
Yeah, he's good looking, he's charismatic, but he's not John Wayne.
Doesn't have the talk or any, doesn't have that walk that he basically did. Like, he did that walk. He would tell young actors, he would tell them, you need to develop like some physical gestures, like my walk. He would said, because if you do that, that's an extra 100 feet of film the editor has to keep in the movie. But he knew, and he would tell the young actors this. He goes, you got to develop these little screen quirks so they have to leave it in the film and you get more screen time. You know, that's the way actors thought back then.
And Wayne was very good at if you watch Stagecoach and watch The Big Trail, these are two totally different people.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to see a guy from go from being an actor to a movie star, like watch those two movies and then go, okay, what happened in between, you know?
Yeah, and he gets trashed by the idiots today because it was politics. But, you know, I always point out, you know, word got out that Rock Hudson was gay in the late 60s. And he couldn't find work. He actually had some problems getting work. And Wayne called him up, said, I got a role for you in The Undefeated. I don't care what your rep is. You show up on time, you'll get paid. You got a role. You know, he would work with people that nobody else wanted to work with because, you know. And he knew what was up, but he's like, he doesn't deserve to get treated like that. So it's like,
He knows if he cares about whether or not you can do the job.
Exactly,
you
know, and
you,
that
you the role. Can you?
I know
it?
we hate George Takei now because he's so annoying. Well, basically, he pays an intern to write all those dumb memes.
Oh
but,
yeah,
but he praised Wayne for working with him on the Green Berets. He said it was fantastic, great guy to work with. So, you know, and they were political opposites, but a lot of those guys were like surprised when they worked with him. It was like got along great with him. Henry Fonda. He got along great with Ford and Wayne, even though they were political opposites. But
yeah,
he get a load of this. Henry Fonda, the big liberal, didn't like hanging out with John Wayne because he cursed too much when he drank. Didn't like the cursing. So it's it was a different world back then.
John Wayne was always like, I don't trust a man who doesn't drink. I'm like,
yeah, exactly.
It's I'm like really, I'm kind of okay if somebody doesn't drink.
Yeah. Do you ever hear stories about Ben Affleck or George Clooney like this? Oh, the spider politics. We got along great. You never hear that. You just hear about what assholes they are.
Yeah. No. You always hear about them mistreating people.
Being dickheads or saying I'll never work with somebody who doesn't vote the way I do, or just dumb shit like that, you know.
But I think that's why Hollywood's
imploding and good.
Oh, it's awful. I hope it goes out of business.
Yep.
No, it's actually kind of wonderful to see the paradigm shift sort of, you know, leveling the ground. It's kind of nice. But I think that Rio Bravo is a movie that, I mean, I know Stu didn't really care for it, but
I wouldn't say I hated it. I just say this, it wasn't for me. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
keep in mind, listeners,
didn't care for it. You know, it just wasn't your thing.
Hey, Americans, Stu's a foreigner, so keep that in mind.
Okay. He's an immigrant. He preferred the John Ford movies.
Well, keep in mind the rest of the world that the Americans are the foreigners as well. So
yeah, that's right.
There's more of us than you.
You know, this is what I find interesting, though, Stu, is I've seen, you know, in recent years, we occasionally see an Australian Western. Like that.
Oh, yeah,
one.
Like,
I'm sorry.
Proposition.
Which I didn't like much. I didn't care much for it. But
I thought it was like Apocalypse Now with Nick Cave music or something. Like it was like Apocalypse Now with a Western aesthetic and Nick Cave music.
Stray made the best Western film of all time, by the way. Mad Max 2.
Yeah, that's true. But it's viewed as a Western in America. They thought of it.
You're not wrong. I almost made a joke earlier about Mel Gibson being the great Western performer.
Well, George Miller had said that in Japan, Mad Max 2 was viewed as a samurai film. In America, it was considered a Western. And he said in Scandinavia, they saw it as a Viking movie.
Yeah.
Well, so that just shows the ubiquitousness of these genres is that they have their place in any culture. You have the Viking in Scandinavian culture. You have the samurai. You know, Yojimbo is the...
Yeah, you know, I just thought about this, Hunter, because you had mentioned that how dark the spaghetti westerns were. I'm thinking that's maybe why Terrence Hill became the biggest spaghetti western star in Italy. It's because his were so whimsical.
His were so fun.
Yeah,
I mean,
him and Bud Spencer are just having fun, and there's nothing dark about them, and they're G-rated in America. So.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I've seen so many spaghetti western movies, and then when I discovered the Terrence Hill stuff, it was like a breath of fresh air. I was like, oh my gosh, these are fun, they're goofy, they're...
Yeah, and fans over here bitch, the spaghetti western fans over here bitch about them, because they're fun.
They do. They think they killed the genre.
It's like, no, they kept it going, they made money.
Yeah, they saved it. I mean, they say, oh, that was the sign that it was over. No, I'm sorry, but when I watch spaghetti westerns, the ones that are the hardest to sit through are the annoying commie ones that are trying to
Bullet
sell
for a general
me,
and
Run Man Run or whatever. I don't know.
All the commie stuff. It's just
I don't want to get a message from Eric saying Run Man Run's really great. I don't remember. But
it's okay. It's not.
I mean, I love Eric. You know,
it's not the big gun down. But But yeah, a lot of those spaghetti westerns, like, there's a phrase for them, and I've forgotten what it is, but stuff like A Bullet for a General, they're just total commie westerns. They're annoying.
Yeah, they are. They're Sergio Corbucci. You know, and Sergio Corbucci even has his fun movies, like Super Fuzz.
Right. His work with Terrence Hill and Spencer, I think, blows away most of his serious stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd rather watch Super Fuzz than most of his other stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Stuart, I think, we're about done. You said you had some announcement before we started recording. I wanted to see what that was.
Oh, yeah. This will be my last episode ever on the MMC because I had to watch Rio Bravo, so I'm done. See you guys.
Oh, damn. That's pretty extreme.
Well, the Edinburgh show.
Well, yeah.
You didn't know how I felt at fucking show. 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, oh, God, I'm listening to John Wayne talk like a retard. Like,
hey, no.
He did that to stretch out the film. Yeah. It's like the editor had to
keep I gotta make sure, but the editor,
you know,
screw me.
I kind of noticed that, too, that everybody was talking slow in the film, and I'm thinking, you know, this is before movies developed that awful California talk they had in the 80s where everybody kind of talks fast, but you don't notice. Mm. But they talk as fast as New Yorkers do. Because before this, you would only see fast dialogue in, like, a New York set film. You know, where, hey, the paper has to go to press tonight! You know, and you'd only, like,
the transatlantic action!
Yeah, Cary Grant. Everybody would talk like Cary Grant with a mid-Atlantic accent, and they just move through the dialogue super quick. And it's like, and it's funny because then they develop that terrible California way of talking, which, you know, makes fast talking easier to go through, I guess. But I noticed it kind of predates that invention of that accent and dialogue.
Best Cary Grant film ever? Arsenic and Old Lace.
Fantastic. I like North by Northwest.
Never seen
Me
it.
Me too.
Yeah, I like
should do that on the show.
To Catch a Thief, I like a lot too. So it's like those are the kind of the prime Cary Grant, but. He did a Howard Hawks movie that's pretty good. Only
Charade's one I like quite a bit, too.
Oh, Charade's great. Actually, I might like Charade more than his Hitchcock movies. It's terrific.
I think I'm with you there.
I have never watched my Criterion disc. I bought it at Barnes & Noble a couple of years ago. We should do a Charade on the show.
No, you've been at it. It's only a Criterion.
I should. I've been trying to force my girlfriend to watch it because she likes the Stanley Donen musicals.
It's a good
movie. Why do you make her watch shit movies, man? What's wrong with you?
Oh my gosh, she's a classic movies fanatic.
So pop on Kiss Me, the Phantom of the Park.
Oh, no, then she'll never watch another movie again.
Oh, shut up.
No, she loves, like, you know, she loves like Singing in the Rain and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And I was like, well, you got to check out the Stanley Donen flick, Charade. But, you know, it's not a musical.
Phantom of the Park is a musical as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it is.
And a fucking good one with that as well.
It's kind of. I mean, here's the thing. She like really splits hairs when it comes to, she's like, that's not a musical. That's a, you know, this or that. Or
oh, I will debate to my grave the Phantom of the Park is a musical.
She didn't like it.
She didn't like it?
Oh, she,
so she disagrees with Tomas Milian.
Yeah, no, we went to see La La Land in the theater. There was a revival of it. And she told me afterwards, she says musicals were the fluff entertainment of their day. And you went to see them to get into a good mood. And then at some point, musicals had to be depressing and annoying. And that's what La La Land was.
She's totally right.
Yep. No, she's absolutely right. She said this movie's about a breakup. And she goes, I don't go to see a musical about a breakup. You know?
Yeah.
she goes,
it's
she said,
post-70s, Hunter. 70s, yeah, I know. Greatest decade of Hollywood ever.
I always joke when we're out, I say, you know, I said, oh, Amy loves movies, but she won't. She as long as it's made before 1965.
That's always the cutoff year for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's just funny. She with La La Land, she was so dead on about that. She was like, yeah, it's about a breakup, and it's a musical, and it's supposed to be an uplifting, fun genre that was the fluff entertainment of its day, and it's depressing.
Yeah,
you should watch Manhunter with her. Good movie.
Yeah.
Well, my problem with the 65 cutoff is okay. Then you're not seeing Dirty Harry. You're not seeing The Godfather one and two. You're not seeing Enter the Dragon. You're not seeing
French Connection. Showed her, I've shown her like select
a Wild Bunch,
and I kind of joke about that. I mean, she's not literally like, I won't watch anything made after.
No, most of those are manly, man-oriented movies.
Yeah, like, I showed her Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and it wasn't like her jam, but she thought Clint Eastwood was awesome. She thought Eli Wallach was hilarious. She thought Lee Van Cleef was, you know, kind of dark and interesting. You know, she definitely got a lot out of it.
You should
enjoy.
You should watch Pink Flamingos with her.
No. Yeah,
no?
Including Pink Flamingos?
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I saw it on Precinct 13. That's just a movie you should never watch with your girlfriend, period.
Yeah. In fact, I told her we were watching Rio Bravo, and I told her the plot to Assault on Precinct 13, and she said, she goes, that sounds interesting. I'd like to watch that. And I was like, I don't know if you would. Like,
No, that one, the ice cream
scene. I said, I don't think that's a movie you would like. I mean, because the kid getting shot and stuff like that. Like, that's
you know, Hitchcock had said, when you kill the kid, you lose the audience. And that's
it's true. And it was this thing like John Carpenter was like, I always kill kids.
Like, yeah, and then he realized, I think he said now he wouldn't do that scene.
What was it? I remember my uncle who's now dead. He walked out of Face Off because the kid got shot in the first scene. He just got up and left the theater.
Jeez.
No, but like, you know, with Robert Rodriguez movies, it was almost a joke. Like the kid getting killed, like it was like a thing. Like, oh, it's like John Carpenter, ha ha ha. But you know,
you're like Planet Terror, yeah.
You do lose the audience.
Well, that's why he's never had a mainstream hit.
Yeah, yeah.
He's never had one. He just has these movies that make a little bit of money, but
like,
he's never had a mainstream hit.
Well, like Planet Terror, like, you know, the kid gets killed in that movie, but it's literally for no reason except as a gag, you know?
Yeah,
because
and he killed his own son. That's what's so odd.
Yeah.
It's a film nerd gag is what it is.
It's like, congratulations, now this is why the Weinsteins are blaming you for the movie flopping instead of the pretentious goofball that made the boring-ass second half of it.
But he gave
them an out right there. They probably could point to that and go, this is why it bombed.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. There's a kid getting killed. You know,
because he's indifferent to the emotions of the audience that you're manipulating when you make these movies.
But yeah, that was. But in Assault on Precinct 13, like that, still, when you watch that movie, that's a shocking moment when the little girl gets.
Well, Hitchcock learned it when he made that movie. Is it Sabotage? I can't remember the title.
I haven't seen it.
A kid has a bomb in a briefcase unknowingly, and he's on a bus, and he blows up, and he's the little kid in the movie. And Hitchcock said, when I did that scene, I lost the audience. They didn't care.
Not these days. Now he'd be a jihadi.
Yeah, exactly.
Alfred Hitchcock is a jihadi.
This is back when it was the view of movies was very pro-Western and not like, oh, these,
The kid was screaming Alfred Akbar.
Jihadis are manipulated by the oil companies, man.
Alfred Akbar! Oh my gosh.
But yeah, it's like he learned. He said the audience tuned out. They didn't care after that. Because, he was one of those directors, I think, it would watch the audience while they were watching the movie.
Yeah.
And he's like,
oh yeah, like Kubrick would do that. Like,
they didn't care after that.
I think Kubrick would, if they were enjoying themselves too much, he would.
Yeah, he was a human insect. Like,
yeah.
His movies are so emotional.
You know, like,
but
Zorak.
I heard that Kubrick would go watch his movies with an audience and then go re-edit his movies based on their reaction, which I think if they were like, if there was too much smiling,
Yeah.
Too bad he didn't edit the second half of Full Metal Jacket. Just make it a 45-minute movie.
The first half of Full Metal Jacket's a great comedy, I think.
Yeah.
Like Arlie Ermey's hilarious.
Yeah, it's very funny. And I had read the novel that was based on a few years before. I didn't know until the day I went to see it, it was based on The Short Timers. And it's funny because the book doesn't have that lengthy ass second. I mean, it has a lot of the same stuff, but it just doesn't take as fucking long to go through.
But everybody says.
Also, in the book, I will say this, that when the sergeant is shot by, Gomer Pyle?
Yeah.
The sergeant actually says, "I'm proud of you." And then he shoots him.
Yeah.
And Kubrick, for some reason, didn't have that in the film, which I thought was weird.
There is a little-known war film that came out in 1981 called The Boys in Company C.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you guys have seen it or not.
Actually.
I think you've brought it up before.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The whole start of Full Metal Jacket with the Arlie Ermey going through and insulting all the new recruits, same thing's done in Boys in Company C, and that was done 6 years earlier.
Yeah,
nobody knows where the fuck to find that movie.
It's hard to see.
Dude, I have seen it available on DVD at store at Movie Trading Company here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Hens Tooth put it out, I think.
Yeah, I think it was Hens Tooth.
Yeah, it's a Golden Harvest production, so that could be a bootleg.
Yeah, like Stuart brought it up on the show one time, and then I saw it for sale at the store, and I was like, oh, that's that movie Stuart was saying.
It's a good movie. Very, very good film. Just no one knows about it.
Yeah. And it's because I think Raymond Chow produced it and made a deal with Columbia. And for some reason, they kept it out of movie and out of TV syndication.
Mm. And it's got the guy from Body Double in it.
Craig Wasson.
Craig Wasson, that's it, yeah.
Craig Wasson, yeah.
Stan Shaw.
And Stan Shaw, yeah.
Later, more known actors in it, but yeah, I've always wanted to see it. Sydney J. Fury directed it, and but it's one of Raymond Chow's first like non kung fu productions for an American studio.
All right. Well, guys, you have anything else you want to add? Because I gotta call it a night here in a little bit.
Nothing that I can think of off the top of my head.
All right, John, what about you? Any closing thoughts on Rio Bravo?
I'd recommend seeing it, but I suspect that most people listening to it have already seen the film. But I don't know how many young listeners we have.
Well, if you haven't seen it, I say go check it out. And
I would say go check it out as well.
Yeah, I mean, even Stuart didn't really care for it, but he'd say go check it out and let us know what you thought.
Yeah, I would say the young filmmakers who listen to us, and we know there's a few of them out there, it's like, if you haven't seen this, you need to check it out to see how adult characters talk in a film. Who act like adults and speak like adults? Because that's something I don't see in movies anymore.
If you want to see like a really well done, dialogueless opening,
yeah,
check that out too. Like the opening to this movie, I think, is legendary for a reason.
Oh, and how many times have you seen the blood on the beer thing redone in like Bond movies with completely
different
outfits? Yeah,
blood in the beer.
Yeah. Mm. Terrific scene.
Blood brew.
All right, guys. Well, let's go ahead and pack it in. You know, you can find us at MidnightMovieCowboys.com if you would like to donate. You can see that on the right-hand side there. Go ahead and fill it out and donate, and we will have a pack of shows coming to you soon. If not, rate and review us on iTunes. That's a great way you can support us free of charge.
Yeah.
And I think that's about it. Anything else, fellas?
Nah, nothing else to promote.
Yeah, go ahead and pick up the album The Illusion by Dream Machine. Best album of 2017 by a mile.
Mm. I haven't heard it. I'll check it out.
Yeah,
local boys for you, Texans.
Mm.
Austin.
Really?
Yeah. That band that were on Castleface Records got booted off because of their the husband and wife, Matthew and Doris Melton, have conservative views. Not alt-right, but conservative views, and they expressed them, and the record label threw them off, and they made the news. You know, Fox News picked up on it. And,
I think I heard about this.
Yeah, I went and bought their album off their personal site. Paid for it, downloaded it, and cracking album. It's as a psychedelic fuzz rock 60s throwback. It's fucking awesome. Best album of the year by a mile.
Really? I might check it out.
By a mile. And you much I love my metal. This is every song, the 11 songs on there are infectious as fuck. It's awesome.
You know, guys, I was thinking, and feel free to shoot this down. But I was thinking
I'm shooting it down.
Month. Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
I was thinking a fun Rock Month episode, like for next year, might be like just reviewing albums from bands we've covered that have come out since we did them. So like the new Darkness album, the new Faith No More, the new Cult, you know, like anything.
Maybe. Like. Yeah, it's a possibility.
I thought that might be like a fun thing, like checking in on bands we've covered. Like just doing
like a rock dump catch up,
checking in on bands we've covered.
I don't know. I thought that might be fun. Anyway, if you like that idea, you know, post in our Facebook group, discussion group.
Yeah, post on the shitbook page.
Yeah.
our newly cleaned group, right?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, we are on Gab now. The MMC.
Oh, we are.
Yes.
Oh, controversial. You
can find us there.
They can't shut us down now.
Nope.
All right. Well, look us up on Gab.
Now I got to follow. Damn.
Yeah, exactly. I have to do that too. All right. Well, thanks everybody for checking in. This has been a good episode. And I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
I'll say Magadog.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.